Hi, welcome to a London Miscellany podcast. My name's Steve. What I hope to do is to bring you some stories about the nation's capital that possibly you haven't heard before. For the last 10 years, I've been hosting guided tours around the city as I'm fascinated by London's history, streets, buildings, and most importantly, the people who once called the city home. While researching these tours, I always collect more information than I need. Sometimes because the story doesn't fit in with the theme of the tour, or possibly there's not enough time to tell it. I feel these are too good to waste, and for the last couple of years I've been posting them on a blog, but more of that later, as I'm itching to get on with the next story. So come with me back to a London that on the surface looks very different. But with human nature being what it is, look a little closer and you'll find nothing really changes. The Monster of London. There have been many violent and disturbing crimes committed in the capital over the centuries. Some single incidents and others of a more serial nature. The latter attract much more attention, sometimes with the culprits achieving cult status. Obviously Jack the Ripper is usually the first to come to mind, along with the latter-day perpetrators John Haig and John Christie. The Limehouse Golem is one that predates the Ripper, and spawned several other mythical beings, such as Spring-Heeled Jack. However, a much more unknown and frankly bizarre character was at work in the late 1780s. Let's start with a definition from the dictionary. The word is piquerism. Piquerism is a sexual interest in penetrating the skin of another person with sharp objects. The most targeted areas of the body are the breasts, buttocks, or groin. During the late Georgian period, London streets became the scene for one of the most bizarre criminal cases in its history. A shady and elusive character stalked female members of the upper classes. His attacks took the form of verbally abusing them prior to stabbing them with a sharp instrument. For 2 years, these attacks generated a wave of public hysteria before unseen in the capital. I'll take you through a chronological record of these attacks. May 1788. There is a small court just off Fleet Street that exists today called Johnson's Court. It was here that the man later known as the Monster of London attacked his first victim. Mrs. Maria Smythe reported that she had been followed as she walked home by a thin man of vulgar appearance. For a while she was unaware of him until he started shouting obscenities at her, these becoming louder and more offensive with every outburst. As she attempted to enter a house in the court, her assailant accosted her, striking her near the breastbone with a sharp blade. The attacker then calmly walked away without a word. The wound was not very severe, amounting to no more than a slight nick to the skin, with little blood loss. The authorities at the time treated the matter with little interest, but nobody could imagine the hysteria that was to follow. September 1789. In a subsequent attack, Miss Mary Foster was assaulted on Dean Street, just along from St Anne's Church in Soho, with the attack following the similar pattern to that mentioned earlier. A week later, Mary was attending a play at Covent Garden Theatre, when to her shock she recognised her assailant leering at her from the seats below. She quickly instructed some nearby gentlemen to apprehend the culprit, which they did. However, the management of the theatre refused to hold the man without a warrant, so Mary's gallant gentleman drifted back to watch the play, leaving the accused man to make his escape, and so an early chance to apprehend the monster was missed in somewhat farcical circumstances. January 1790. Perrault's Bagnio was a hotel and cold bath established in St James's. It stood roughly where Blue Ball Alley meets St James's Street today. Following the celebrations to mark Queen Charlotte's birthday, the two daughters of the owner, Anne and Sarah Porter, were attacked by the monster while walking home. In a departure from his modus operandi, Anne was knocked unconscious, while the attack on Sarah followed the same course as previous attacks. Obviously incensed and upset by the attack, their father, Thomas Porter, immediately went to Bow Street Public Office to report the incident. On arrival, he found that the monster had enjoyed an extremely busy day, having attacked another four women. One of these was a Miss Felton, who was attacked on Dover Street, very close to Berkeley Square. This seemed to have been a more frenzied attack than normal, with the unfortunate girl's clothing being badly shredded. She was lucky to escape injury when her attacker stabbed her in the upper thigh, his blade lodging in an apple that she was carrying in her pocket. April 1790. Around this time, the monster takes a new approach to the attacks. The verbal insults seem to have disappeared. Instead, he takes to the streets carrying a nosegay, a bunch of flowers used to help ward off the foul smells prevalent in Georgian London. Inside the nosegay is concealed a stiletto blade or sharp spike. The victim is invited to smell the charming aroma of flowers and then stabbed in the face. There are several instances of these attacks, one being on a servant girl on the Strand who was badly cut to the face during the malicious attack. Several victims reported that the flowers looked and smelt artificial, something that would be significant later in the case. Hysteria had risen to unprecedented levels, with daily attacks, sightings and even detentions of the monster becoming commonplace. These all proved unfounded, and the magistrates were coming under intense pressure to detain the culprit. Monster clubs were formed in order to patrol the city. Gentlemen vigilantes sporting a club tie pin were seen frequently patrolling the streets in the most fashionable areas. One of these was the wealthy insurance broker John Julius Angerstein. He started a subscription for raising a reward for the capture and conviction of the monster. There is evidence that his actions were not all public-spirited, as his endeavours to apprehend the perpetrator brought him into close contact with many of the fashionable young ladies of society, and it's noted that he took the opportunity to call on them to discuss their safety with great enthusiasm. May 1790. Early in the month, a chance to apprehend the monster was missed, again in farcical circumstances. During the early evening in Arlington Street, just behind where the Ritz Hotel is today, a young woman was attacked. A Dr. Bush witnessed the attack and, despite being of advanced years, valiantly attempted to intervene. Brandishing his cane, he accosted the assailant, halting the attack. Unfortunately, he was unable to detain the man, who calmly walked off into the darkening streets. Two bystanders ran to the woman's aid, and one of them accompanied Dr. Bush in pursuit of the attacker. They finally caught up with him on the corner of St. James's Street and Piccadilly. But just as they were about to apprehend the man, Dr. Bush was grabbed by the arms by a portly individual who accused him of being the monster. Within a minute, a crowd had formed, all baying for the chance to extract retribution on the hapless Dr. Bush. If it hadn't been for the appearance of the victim, who assured everyone that they had got the wrong man, then Dr. Bush's fate could have been a lot worse than a light roughing up at the hands of the mob that he suffered. Meanwhile, the real culprit had melted away into the city's gathering gloom. If anything, the space of attacks increased during May. However, it seemed that the monster was becoming less discerning about the social status of his victims. One such was a Mrs. Elizabeth Davis, a Holborn washerwoman. She was approached by a man offering a nosegay and was invited to smell it, to which she refused, claiming that the flowers looked artificial. The man became agitated and, grabbing her by the throat, slashed her thigh and chest with a blade. On returning home, she summoned the Bow Street runners and passed on the detailed description of a tall, elegantly dressed man. It's interesting to note that victims were now imbued with a certain cachet, and Mrs. Davis is reported to have been a bit surprised and even a little flattered to have been the target of the man's attentions, since he was known for targeting the well-to-do only. Later the same day, a watchman spotted a man fitting Mrs. Davis's description and decided to follow him to an address in Castle Street. The suspect stopped outside number 11. Noting down the address, the watchman immediately left and passed it on to the Bow Street runners. What he had failed to notice was that the man did not actually enter the house. During the subsequent raid, no man fitting the description was found, and a maid recounted a tale from earlier in the day when she attended a loud knock on the front door to find that there was nobody there. This led Magistrate Sir Sampson Wright to publicly declare that they were dealing with a criminal of superior intelligence. On the 13th of June, Anne Porter, remember her from the Perio Bagni attack, was walking in St James's Park with her mother and an admirer, a fishmonger called John Coleman. During their walk, Miss Porter was heard to utter a cry of anguish and then proceeded to fall down on the floor in a swoon. Smelling salts were administered, and the young lady, coming to her senses, said that she had seen her attacker walking a little way in front of them. The party set off at a brisk walk, and several minutes later, Miss Porter identified the man 20 or so yards in front of them. Pointing the man out to Coleman, it seems that in today's vernacular, he bottled it. Instead of heroically tackling him to the ground and calling for the watchman, he decided on a plan of following the culprit at a distance without any great risk to his own person. This led to a long and drawn-out pursuit at walking pace all through the St James's area. As the pursuit continued, it must have dawned on Coleman that to return to the Porters without the capture of the monster was going to do untold damage to his courtship with Miss Porter. Bizarrely, Coleman decides on a ploy of trying to antagonise the monster into some form of action that will result in a scene to which supposedly a crowd would gather and help him detain the man. So Coleman quickens his pace, overtakes the man, then stops, delivering menacing glares to the man as he passes by. He even leans over his shoulder when the man stops to look in a shop window, shouting, "Boo! Boo! Boo!" in the man's face. This plan seems to have no effect on the monster whatsoever, who saunters along until he reaches a house in South Moulton Street. Coleman keeps watch, and after a short time the man leaves. Instead of following him, Coleman decides to knock on the door of the house, and after a protracted conversation, manages to elicit the name and address of the man from the householder, Mr. Williams, 52 German Street. He decides that this information will help him save face when he retraces his steps back to the Porters. But it doesn't take him long, however, for the realisation to dawn on him that perhaps a man of cunning, such as the monster, would not willingly give away his identity. The hapless Coleman then spends the rest of the day trying to locate the man that he has let slip from his grasp. During the hunt, Coleman suddenly realises that the man he has followed is actually known to him, having been introduced by a mutual friend some weeks earlier. I think it's easy to comprehend the state that Coleman was in by now, probably near blind panic, as whichever way this plays out, his chances in the matrimonial stakes seem to be reaching a very low level. You can imagine his delight by when, complete accident, he rediscovers the man walking towards him down Pall Mall. Again he shies away from physically detaining the man, but approaches him and renews his acquaintance. What the man thought after Coleman's strange tactics earlier in the day is a bit of a mystery. Coleman suggests to the man that he has been accused of insulting a female friend of his, but as they know each other, albeit tenuously, he can't imagine this to be the case. He suggests that the man accompany him to meet the lady friend and clear the matter up. To this the man meekly objects, saying that it was too late in the day, but when pressed, he agrees to go with Coleman without much resistance. They return to Perro's Bagno, where the sisters Porters both faint on the first sight of the man coming through the door. Anne exclaims, "Good God, that is the wretch!" Their father has none of Coleman's qualms about detaining the man and pins him to the wall, swearing, "Sir, move a muscle and you will live to regret it." The man, now greatly alarmed at this turn of events, denies all knowledge of the attacks and even comes up with an alibi for the attack on the Porter sisters. Within an hour, the man who gives his name as Mr. Williams is in the custody of the Bow Street Runners. He's actually under the arrest of runner John McManus, who had previously been bodyguard to King George III. Williams is taken to New Prison, Clerkenwell, where he gives his name as Rinnick Williams and his occupation as a maker of artificial flowers. He lodges at a dingy alehouse, the George, in Bury Street, St James's, where he shares a single room with six other men. McManus searches the room and finds clothing similar to the description given of the attacker, but no weapons which might have been used in the attacks. Monday the 14th of June. The following day, Williams appears at the magistrates at Bow Street and presents his alibi for the Porter attacks, saying that he had spent the day working at the artificial flower factory of Mrs. Annabel Mitchell in Dover Street. As in those days, an identification parade was held before the magistrates. However, the results were mixed. Several victims positively identified Williams as their attacker, while some said he only bore a resemblance to the man. A good number attested that Williams wasn't their attacker at all. The magistrates wanted more time to decide on the charges, and so Williams was driven back to Clerkenwell. Running the gauntlet of an angry mob who had gathered outside the prison, he was nearly torn to shreds, but was retrieved from the mob by several of the runners. The magistrate's dilemma was with which crime to charge Williams with, a felony or a misdemeanour. The first, punishable by death, and the second by prison, flogging or pillory. The mood of the public was high on the magistrate's agenda, and they sought for the felony charge. However, common assault, even with the intent to kill, was only classed as a misdemeanour. Therefore, an obscure and slightly ridiculous law from the 1720s was used, which deemed it a felony to assault somebody in the street with the intent to damage their clothing. This, carrying a greater charge to the physical assault, seems perverse to our eyes, but in the context of the times, the assault on property was given greater value to that of the assault on the person. Williams was brought before the magistrates again on the 18th of June and charged with the assault with intent to do damage to the clothing of the victim. He was then taken back to Clerkenwell and left to await his trial at the Old Bailey. July 1790. On the 8th of July, Williams stood trial at the Old Bailey. Anticipation, rumour and speculation had reached fever pitch in the weeks leading up to the trial, and many images of the supposed monster had been published, depicting him as a terrifying, large, aggressive, knife-wielding maniac. So it was somewhat of a shocking anticlimax when the small, rather meek-looking Williams first appeared in the dock. Despite the large number of witnesses called, the judge, Mr. Justice Francis Buller, seemed to have wanted to get the trial over as quickly as possible, and so it was on the same day that the jury were sent out to consider their verdict. It came as no surprise that after a short period of time they returned the guilty verdict. Williams was returned to prison to await sentencing. September 1790. Williams had been languishing in the squalid conditions of Newgate for 2 months when some aid came to his cause through the publication of a pamphlet entitled The Monster at Large. This had been written by Theophilus Swift, a relative of the novelist Jonathan Swift. The case he outlined focused on the obscurity of the law used to convict Williams, legal contradictions during the trial, and the defence of Williams' character. Swift was something of a self-promoter, taking every opportunity of provoking the establishment, and would readily have seen the publicity that the release of this pamphlet would generate. November 1790. It was becoming clear that sentiment around the charge that William had faced was beginning to turn in his favour, possibly because of the pamphlet, and Swift was very vocal in claiming that it was. 12 judges met on the 10th of November at the Sergeant's Hall near Fleet Street to consider the matter. They decided that the felony charge of damaging clothing was untenable and that Williams should be retried under the misdemeanour charge of willfully and maliciously cutting with intent to kill. December 1790. Williams appeared at the Old Bailey on the 8th of December and was discharged of the felony by Judge Ashurst, with a new trial for the misdemeanour to take place. On Monday the 13th of December, Williams appears at the Hicks Hall in Clerkenwell, charged with the misdemeanour of cutting with the intent to kill. The trial would have been a modern newspaper hack's dream. It had all the drama, pathos, and is so typical in the whole case, farce. Williams appoints the self-aggrandising Swift to conduct his defence, who, realising Williams' appearance and demeanour is a trump card, has him making a pitiful and pathetic speech to the court. Williams bemoans his situation and the prejudice against him, and even admits to deciding to plead guilty until talked out of it by friends on the morning of the trial. Despite his pomposity, Swift seems to be a crafty man to have in your corner, and uses William's change of heart to tell the judge that he has been given insufficient time to prepare witnesses for the defence, but requests that he be allowed to call employees of the artificial flower factory to attest to William's alibi. This granted, the witnesses arrive in a very short time, and it was reported by some observers that the whole exercise was a charade put together by Swift, as all the employers had been seen loitering in a tavern just across from the hall before being called. Swift, aggressively and improperly, questions the mostly female witnesses, and during the turn of Anne Porter, accuses her and her family of running a brothel at Perrault's Bagneux, to which the young lady duly faints, earning Swift a stern rebuke from the judge. Despite his aggressive manner and unsubstantiated claims, Swift comes off second best in the legal arguments and is outmanoeuvred by his adversary, Mr. Piggott. After several hours of rambling speeches, the jury is sent out to consider the verdict. At a quarter to midnight, they return to find Williams guilty of the assaults on the two Porter sisters. The following day, the trial continues, with Swift unable to combat the claims of further witnesses, and Williams is found guilty of two further offences and is sentenced to 6 years in Newgate Prison. July 1792. 2 years into his sentence, William decides that he must try to do something to clear his name, or at least start a campaign for a retrial. He produces a self-funded pamphlet entitled An Appeal to the Public by Rinnett Williams, containing observations and reflections on facts relative to his very extraordinary and melancholy case. This was filled with spurious and pathetic ruminations on his current state, attacks on the fishmonger John Coleman, who had lured him towards his capture, who he called a cowardly and impotent creature. Also a rather far-fetched claim that the monster was still at large and preying on the female populations of both Bristol and Watford. Unsurprisingly, the pamphlet has no effect on public opinion. In another farcical twist to the tale, he is joined inside Newgate in 1795 by his former advocate, Theophilus Swift, who is incarcerated for a year for libel. There are few documents relating to William's remaining stay in Newgate, but it does look as though life was not entirely without joy. In May 1795, his son, conceived in Newgate with another inmate, Elizabeth Robbins, was christened at St. Sepulchre's Church opposite Newgate Prison. Having served his sentence, Williams fades from history, and the only remaining record shows his marriage to Elizabeth Robbins at St. Pancras Old Church in 1797. You've been listening to a London Miscellany podcast, which was written and produced by me, Steve Matthews. You can find more stories and information about the tours that I host by visiting www.alondonmiscellany.com. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to check out other episodes. Goodbye.